wife. She straightened up abruptly, then rose.
I think I shall bring in a bit more firewood for tonight, she announced,
and grain the jepas. There is scarcely a twig for them to browse on here. I watched her leave the tent for the dark and still cold outside. No one spoke a word. After a breath or two, I rose and followed her.
Don't be long,
Kettle warned me enigmatically. The wolf shadowed after me. Outside, the night was clear and cold. The wind was no worse than usual. Familiar discomforts can almost be ignored. Ketrikin was neither fetching wood nor graining the jepas. I was sure both tasks had already been done earlier. Instead, she was standing at the edge of the cloven road, staring out over the blackness of cliff at her feet. She stood tall and stiff as a soldier reporting to his sergeant, and made not a sound. I knew she was crying. There is a time for courtly manners, a time for formal protocol, and a time for humanity. I went to her, took her by the shoulders, and turned her to face me. She radiated misery, and the wolf beside me whined high. Ketrikin, I said simply, he loves you. He will not blame you. He will grieve, yes, but what kind of a man would not? As for Regal's deeds, they are Regal's deeds. Do not take the blame for those to yourself. You could not have stopped him. She wiped a hand across her face and did not speak. She looked past me, her face a pale mask in the starlight. She sighed heavily, but I could sense her strangling on her sorrow. I set my arms about my queen and pulled her to me, pressing her face to my shoulder. I stroked her back, feeling the terrible tension there. It's all right. I lied to her. It's going to be all right. In time, you'll see, you'll be together again. You'll make another child. Both of you will sit in the great hall at Buckkeep and listen to the minstrels sing. There will be peace again somehow. You've never seen Buckkeep at peace. There will be time for Verity to hunt and fish, and you'll ride at his side. Verity will laugh and shout and roar through the halls like the north wind again. Cook used to chase him out of the kitchen for slicing the meat from the roast before it was cooked through. He would come home from the chase that hungry. He'd come right in and cut the leg off a cooking fowl, that he would, and carry it about with him, telling stories in the guardroom, waving it about like a sword. I patted her back as if she were a child, and told her tales of the bluff, hearty man I remembered from my boyhood. For a time, her forehead rested on my shoulder, and she was completely still. Then she coughed once, as if starting to choke. But instead, terrible sobs welled up from her. She cried suddenly and unabashedly as a child that has taken a bad fall and is hurt as well as frightened. I sensed these were tears that had long gone unshed, and I did not try to help her stop. Instead, I went on talking and patting her, scarcely hearing what I was saying myself, until her sobs began to quiet and her shaking to still. At last, she drew away from me a little, to grope in her pocket for a handkerchief. She wiped her face and eyes and blew her nose before she tried to speak.
I'm going to be all right, she said.
To hear the strength of her belief in those words made my heart ache.
It's hard just now, waiting to tell him all these terrible things, knowing how they will hurt him. They taught me so many things about being sacrifice fits. From the beginning, I knew I might have terrible sorrows to bear. I am strong enough to bear these things. But no one warned me that I might come to love the man they'd choose for me. To bear my sorrow is one thing. To bring sorrow to him is another.
Her throat closed on the words, and she bowed her head. I feared she might begin to weep again. Instead, when she lifted her head, she smiled at me. Moonlight touched the silver wetness on her cheeks and lashes.
Sometimes I think only you and I see the man beneath the crown. I want him to laugh and roar about, and leave his bottles of ink open and his maps scattered about. I want him to put his arms about me and hold me. Sometimes I want those things so much, I forget about the red ships and Regal and everything else. Sometimes I think that if we could only be together again, all the rest would come right as well. It is not a very worthy thought to have. A sacrifice is supposed to be more... A glint of silver behind her caught my eyes.
I saw the black column over her shoulder. It leaned at a cant over the broken edge of the road, half its stone support gone. I did not hear the rest of what she said. I wondered how I had not seen it before. It gleamed brighter than the moon on the sparkling snow. It was hewn of black stone, webbed with glittering crystal, like moonlight on a rippling river of skill. I could decipher no writing on its surface. The wind was screaming behind me as I reached out and ran a hand down that smooth stone. It welcomed me. 27. The city. There runs through the mountain kingdom an old trade trail that serves none of the present-day towns of the mountain kingdom. Portions of this old highway appear as far south and east as the shore of Blue Lake. The trail is not named. No one recalls who constructed it, and few use it even for the stretches that remain intact. In places, the road has been gradually destroyed by the freezing swells that are common in the mountains. In other places, flooding and landslides have reduced it to rubble. Occasionally, an adventurous mountain youth will undertake to trace the road to its source. Those who return have tall tales of ruined cities and steaming valleys where the sulphurous ponds smoke. And they speak, too, of the forbidding nature of the territory the road spans. No game and poor hunting, they say, and it is not recorded anywhere that anyone has ever been impressed enough to make a return trip to the road's end. I stumbled to my knees in the snowy street. I got to my feet slowly, groping for a memory. Had I got drunk? The queasiness, the dizziness were right for that, but not this darkly gleaming and silent city. I looked all around me. I was in a town square of some sort, standing in the shadow of a looming stone memorial of some kind. I blinked my eyes, squeezed them shut, then opened them again. The nebulous light still fogged me. I could scarcely see more than an arm's length in any direction. I waited, in vain, for my eyes to adjust to the vague starlight. But soon I began to shiver, so I began to walk silently through the empty streets. My natural wariness came back first, followed by a dim recollection of my companions. The tent. The sundered road. But between that hazy memory and my standing up in this street, there was nothing. I looked back the way I had come. Darkness had swallowed the road behind me. Even my footprints were being filled in by the slowly falling damp snowflakes. I blinked snowflakes from my eyelashes and peered about me. I saw the damply glistening sides of stone buildings to either side of the street. My eyes could make no sense of the light. It was sourceless and evenly insufficient. There were no looming shadows or especially dark alleys, but neither could I make out where I was going. The heights and styles of the buildings, the destinations of the streets, remained a mystery. I felt a panic rise in me and fought it down. The sensations I had reminded me too vividly of how I had been skill-deceived in Regal's manner. I was terrified to grope out with the skill, lest I encounter Will's taint in this city. But if I moved blindly on, trusting that I was not being deceived, I might blunder into a trap. In the shelter of a wall, I paused and forced myself to composure. I tried once more to recall how I had come here, how long ago I had left my companions, and why. Nothing came to me. I quested out with my wit sense, trying to find night eyes. But I sensed nothing else alive. I wondered if there were truly no living creatures nearby, or if my wit sense had once more failed. I had no answers to that either. When I listened, I heard only the wind. I smelled only damp stone, fresh snow, and somewhere, perhaps, river water. Panic rose in me once more, and I leaned back against the wall. The city suddenly sprang to life around me. I perceived I was leaning up against the wall of an inn. From within I heard the sounds of a shrill piping instrument and voices lifted in an unfamiliar song. A wagon rumbled past in the street, and then a young couple darted past the mouth of the alley, hand in hand, laughing as they ran. It was night in this strange city, but it was not sleeping. I lifted my eyes to the impossible heights of their strangely spired buildings, and saw lights burning in the upper stories. In the distance, a man called loudly to someone. My heart was hammering. What was wrong with me? I steeled myself and found the resolve to go forth and find out what I could about this strange city. I waited until another keg-laden ale-wagon had rumbled past the mouth of my alley. Then I stepped away from the wall. And in that instant, all was once more quiet, gleaming darkness. Gone were the song and laughter from the tavern. No one passed in the streets. I ventured to the mouth of the alley and peered cautiously in both directions. Nothing. Only softly falling wet snow. At least, I told myself, the weather was milder here than it had been on the road above. Even if I had to spend the entire night out of doors, I would not suffer too much. I wandered a time through the city. At every intersection I chose the widest road to follow, and soon realized a pattern of always going gently downhill. The river smell grew stronger. I paused once to rest on the edge of a great circular basin that might have enclosed a fountain or been a washing court. Immediately, the city once more sprang to life around me. A traveller came and watered his horse at the dry basin so close that I could have reached out to touch him. He noticed me not at all, but I marked well the strangeness of his garb and the odd shape of the saddle the horse wore. A group of women walked past me, talking and laughing quietly together. They wore long, straight garments that hung softly from their shoulders and fluttered about their calves as they walked. All wore their long, fair hair loose to their hips, and their boots rang on the cobbled street. When I rose to speak to them, they vanished, and the light with them. Twice more I woke the city before I realized all it took was the touch of my hand on a crystal-veined wall. It took an unreasonable amount of courage, but I began to walk with just my fingers trailing along the building's sides. When I did so, the city bloomed into life about me as I walked. It was night, and the quiet snow still fell. The passing wagons left no tracks in it. I heard the slamming of doors that had long since rotted away, and saw folk walk lightly over a deep gully some wild rainstorm had created down one street. It was hard to dismiss them as ghosts when they called greetings aloud to one another. I was the one who was ignored and invisible as I drifted along. At length, I came to a wide, black river flowing smoothly under the starlight. Several ghost quays ran out into it, and two immense ships were anchored out in the river. Lights shone from their decks. Hogsheads and bales waited dockside to be loaded. A huddle of folk were engaged in some game of chance, and someone's honesty was being loudly disputed. They dressed differently from the river rats who came into Buck, and the language was different. But in all else that I could tell, they were the same breed. As I watched, a fight broke out and spread to become a general brawl. It dispersed quickly, when the whistle of a night watch sounded, combatants fleeing in all directions before the city guard arrived. I lifted my hand from the wall. I stood a moment in the snow-spangled darkness, letting my eyes adjust. Ships, keys, river folk were all gone, but the quiet black water still flowed, steaming into the colder air. I walked toward it, feeling the road go rough and broken under my feet as I advanced. The waters of this river had risen and fallen over this street, working their damage with no one to oppose them. When I turned my back to the river and studied the skyline of the city, I could see the faint silhouettes of fallen spires and crumpled walls. Once again I quested out about me. Once again I found no life. I turned back to the river. Something in the general configuration of the land tugged at my memory. It was not precisely here, I knew that, but I felt sure that this was the river where I had seen Verity lave his hands and arms and bring them out, gleaming with magic. Cautiously, I walked over the broken paving stones right down to the edge of the river. It looked like water. It smelled like water. I crouched down beside it and thought. I had heard tales of pools of tarry mud covered over with water. I knew well how oil floated upon water. Perhaps beneath the black water there flowed another river, one of silver power. Perhaps farther upstream or down was the tributary of pure skill I had seen in my vision. I drew off my mitten and bared my arm. I set my hand upon the flow of the river, feeling its icy kiss against my bare palm. Senses straining, I tried to detect whether there was skill beneath that surface. I felt nothing. But perhaps if I plunged in my arm and hand, they would come up gleaming with strength. I dared myself to reach in to discover for myself. That was as far as my courage went. I was no Verity. I knew the strength of his skilling. I had seen how his immersion in the magic had tried his will. I was no match for it. He had marched alone up the skill road while I... My mind darted back to that puzzle. When had I left the skill road and my companions? Perhaps I never had. Perhaps all this was a dream. I reached up and patted cold water on my face. I felt no different. I set my nails to my face and scratched the skin until it hurt. It proved nothing to me, but only made me wonder if I could dream pain. I had found no answers in this strange, dead city. Only more questions. With great resolve, I turned my steps back the way I had come. Visibility was poor, and the clinging snow was rapidly filling my footprints. With reluctance, I set my fingers to the stone of a wall. It was easier to trace my way back that way, for the living city had had more landmarks than the cold cinders of it did. Yet as I hurried through the snowy streets, I wondered when all these folk had been here. Did I view the events of a night 100 years ago? Had I come here another night, would I view the same events played out? Or see a different night from the city's history? Or did these shades of folk perceive themselves as living now? Was I an odd, cold shadow that crept through their lives? I forced myself to stop wondering about things I had no answer to. I had to trace my way back the way I had come. Either I had come to the end of places I could remember, or I took a wrong turning. The result was the same. I found myself wandering up a road I was sure was unfamiliar. I trailed my fingers down the fronts of a row of shops, all locked up tight for the night. I passed two lovers locked in an embrace in a doorway. A ghost dog padded past me without giving me so much as a curious sniff. Despite the milder weather, I was getting cold and tired. I glanced up at the sky. It would soon be morning. By daylight I could perhaps climb up one of the buildings and get the lay of the land. Perhaps, when I awoke, I would recall how I came here. Foolishly I cast about for some overhanging eave or shed where I might shelter before it occurred to me that there was no reason not to go inside one of the buildings. Even so, I felt queer as I chose a door and walked through it. While I touched a wall, I saw a dim interior. Tables and shelves were laden with fine pottery and glassware. A cat slept by a banked hearth. When I lifted my hand from the wall, all was cold and pitch black. So I trailed my fingers along the wall, nearly stumbling over the crumbling remains of one of the tables. I stooped and gathered together the bits by touch and took them to the hearth. By great perseverance I made a true fire of them where the ghost fire burned. When it was going well and I stood over it to warm myself, its flickering light showed me a different view of the room. Bare walls and debris-strewn floor. There was no trace of the fine crockery and glassware, though there were a few more bits of wood from long-fallen shelves. I thanked my luck that they had been made of good oak, for surely they would have rotted to splinters long ago if they had not. I decided to lay my cloak on the floor to save me from the stone's chill and trust my fire to keep me warm enough. I lay down and closed my eyes and tried not to think of ghost cats or what phantom folk slept in their beds on the floor above me. I tried to set my skill walls before I slept, but it was rather like drying one's feet while standing in a river. The closer I came to sleep, the harder it was to recall where those boundaries lay. How much of my world was me and how much was the folk I cared about? I dreamed first of Ketriken, Starling, Kettle, and the Fool, wandering about with torches, while Night Eyes ran back and forth, whining. It was not a comfortable dream, and I turned away from it and drifted deeper into myself. Or so I supposed. I found the familiar hut. I knew the simple room, the rough table, the tidy hearth, the narrow bed so neatly made. Molly sat in her nightrobe by the hearth, rocking nettle, and singing softly a song about stars and starfish. I could recall no lullabies, and was as charmed by it as nettle. The baby's wide eyes were on Molly's face, as her mother sang. She gripped one of Molly's forefingers in her small fist. Molly sang the song over and over and over. But I found no boredom there. It was a scene I could watch for a month, for a year, and never know tedium. But the babe's eyelids slid shut once, to open quickly. They closed more slowly a second time, and stayed closed. Her tiny pursed mouth moved as if she suckled in her sleep. Her black hair had begun to curl. Molly lowered her face to brush her lips across Nettle's forehead. Molly rose wearily and carried the baby to her bed. She pulled open the blanket, nestled the child in, and then went back to the table to blow out the single candle there. By the light of the hearth, I watched her ease into bed beside the child and draw the blankets up over them both. She closed her eyes and sighed, and did not stir again. I watched over her leaden sleep, recognizing it as the sleep of exhaustion. I knew sudden shame. This hard, bare life was not anything I ever envisioned for her, let alone our child. Were it not for Burrich, life would be even harder for them.
I fled from seeing this way, promising myself things will get better. Somehow I will make things better for them when I return.
I expected by the time I returned things would be better. But this is too good to trust, in a way.
It was Chade's voice. He leaned over a table in a darkened room, studying a scroll. A branch of candles lit his face, and the unrolled map before him. He looked tired, but in good spirits. His grey hair was dishevelled, his white shirt was half open and loose of his breeches, so it hung about his hips like a skirt. The old man was lean and muscular, where before he was skinny. He took a long draw from a steaming mug and shook his head over something.
Regal seems to gain no ground in his war against the mountains. In every attack against the border towns, the usurper's troops faint and then withdraw. There is no concerted effort to seize territory they have ravaged, no massing of troops to force their way to Jampe. What is his game?
Come here, and I'll show you. Chade looked up from his scroll, half amused and half annoyed.
I've a serious question to ponder. I'll not find the answer to this in your bed.
The woman threw back the bedding and rose to pad softly over to the table. She moved like a stalking cat. Her nakedness was not vulnerability, but armor. Her long brown hair had pulled loose of its warrior tail to reach past her shoulders. She was not young, and long ago a sword had left its tracks down her ribs. She was still breathtaking in a formidable female way. She bent over the map beside him and pointed to something.
Look here, and here, and here. Were you regal? Why would you attack all these places at once, with forces too small to hold any of them?
When Chade did not answer, she moved her finger to tap another spot on the map.
None of those attacks came as any great surprise. Mountain troops that had been gathered here were diverted to these two villages. Another second force from this location went to the third village. Now, see where the mountain troops were not?
There's nothing along there worth having.
Nothing, she agreed. But once there was a trade route that went through the lesser pass, here, and thence into the heart of the mountains. It bypasses Jampe, and is little used any more for that reason. Most traders want a route that will allow them to sell and trade in Jampe as well as the lesser towns.
Of what value is that to Regal? Does he seek to take and hold it?
No. No troops have been seen there at all.
Where does the trail lead?
Now? Nowhere, save a few scattered villages. But it is good travelling for a small force moving fast.
Where does it go?
It dwindles away at Shishu.
She tapped another spot on the map. But it would carry that hypothetical band of warriors deep into mountain territory, well behind all the troops watching and guarding the border, west of Jampe, and unsuspected.
But what would be their goal?
The woman shrugged casually and smiled to see Chade's eyes leave the map.
Perhaps an assassination attempt on King Eod? Perhaps an attempt to recapture this bastard that is supposed to be sheltering in the mountains? You tell me. This is more your trade than mine. Poison the wells at Jampe?
Chade suddenly paled.
It's been a week. They'll already be in place, their plot already in motion.
He shook his head.
What am I to do?
Were it I'd send a swift courier to King Eod, a lass on a horse, alert him that there may be spies at his back.
I suppose that's best.
Chade agreed. There was a sudden weariness in his voice.
Where are my boots?
Relax. The messenger was sent yesterday. By now, King Eod's trackers will be working the trail. He has very good trackers.
I can vouch for that. Chade looked at her consideringly, in a way that had nothing to do with her nakedness. You know the quality of his trackers. Yet you sent one of your own lasses to his very doorstep, with a missive penned by your own hand. To warn him.
I saw no good in letting such tidings wait.
Chade smoothed his short beard over his jaw. When I first asked your aid, you told me you'd work for coin, not patriotism. You told me that to a horse thief, one side of the border was as good as another.
She stretched, rolling her shoulders. She stepped to face him, placing her hands on his hips in calm assumption. They were nearly of a height. Perhaps you have won me to your side.
His green eyes gleamed like a hunting cat's.
Have I?
He mused as he drew her closer. I came to myself with a small start and shifted uncomfortably. I felt ashamed to have spied on Chade, and envious of him as well. I poked a bit at my fire and lay down again, reminding myself that Molly also slept alone, save for the small warmth of our daughter. It was little comfort, and my sleep was restless for the remainder of the night. When I opened my eyes again, a square of watery sunlight overlay me from the unshuttered window. My fire had burned to a few coals, but I was not that cold. In the light of day, the chamber I was in was dismal. I went and peered into a second room, seeking a stairway to the upper stories that might offer me a better view of the city. Instead, I saw the sagging remnants of wooden steps I dared not trust, even for a brief ascent. The damp was heavier as well. The dank, cold stone walls and floor reminded me of the dungeons of Buckkeep. I left the shop, stepping out into a day that seemed almost warm. Last night's snow was retreating into puddles. I took off my hat and let the gentler wind move against my hair. Spring, some part of me whispered. The edge of spring was in the air. I had expected that daylight would vanquish the phantom denizens of the city. Instead, the light seemed to make them stronger. Black stone with quartz-like veins had been used widely in constructing the city, and I had but to touch any piece of it to see the city's life awaken around me. But even when I touched nothing, I still seemed to catch glimpses of folk, to hear the murmur of their chatter and sense the tumult of their passage. I walked for some time, seeking a tall, mostly intact building that would offer me the view I sought. By daylight, the city was far more ruined than I had suspected. Whole domes of roofs had fallen in, and some buildings had great cracks, green with moss, running up their walls. In others, outer walls had fallen away entirely, exposing the inner chambers and filling the street below with rubble I must clamber over. Few of the taller buildings were totally intact, and some leaned drunkenly against one another. I finally saw a likely building with a tall spire peeping up above its neighbors, and made my way toward it. When I reached it, I wasted some little time in standing and staring up at it. I wondered if it had been a palace. Great lions of stone guarded the entrance steps. The exterior walls were of the same shining black stone I had come to regard as the common building material for the city, but affixed to them were silhouettes of folk and beasts, all cut from some gleaming white stone. The stark contrast of white on black and the grand scale of these images made them almost overwhelming. A giant of a woman gripped an immense plough behind a team of monstrous oxen. A winged creature, perhaps a dragon, took an entire wall to himself.
I slowly climbed the wide stone steps to the entryway. It seemed to me that as I did so, the murmuring of the city grew louder and more insistently real. A grinning young man came hastening down the steps, a scroll gripped in one hand. I sidestepped to avoid colliding with him, but as he hastened past I felt not the slightest sense of his being. I turned to stare after him. His eyes had been yellow as amber. The great wooden doors were closed and had been latched, but so rotten were they that one cautious push tore the lock free. One door swung open, while the other sagged gratefully down to collapse on the floor. I peered in before I entered. Streaked and dusty windows of thick glass admitted the winter sunlight. Dust motes from the settling door danced in the air. I half expected bats or pigeons or a scurrying rat or two. There was nothing. Not even a scent of animal habitation. Like the road, the city was avoided by wild beasts. I stepped inside, my boots scuffing lightly on the dusty floors. There were the tatters of ancient hangings, a collapsed wooden bench. I lifted my eyes to a ceiling far above my head. This chamber alone could have held the entire exercise grounds at Buckkeep. I felt tiny. But across the chamber from me were stone steps, marching up into the gloom. As I crossed them, I heard the businesslike mutter of talk, and suddenly the stairs were peopled with tall, robed folk coming and going. Most gripped scrolls or clutched papers, and the tone of their conversation was that of people discussing weighty matters. They were subtly different from any folk I had ever been among. The color of their eyes were too bright, the bones of their bodies were elongated, but for all that, much else about them was ordinary. This must have been some chamber of laws or ruling, I decided. Only such matters put lines upon so many brows and scowls on so many faces. There were a number of folk in yellow robes and black leggings, bearing a sort of insignia plate upon their shoulders, and these I judged to be officials. As I climbed first one staircase and then another, from the second floor, these yellow robes increased in number. The stairs were somewhat lit by the wide windows at each landing. The first showed me only the upper story of the next building. On the second landing, I gained a view of some roofs. The third floor I had to cross to reach another stairway. Judging by the generous tatters on the walls, this floor had been even more opulent. I began to perceive ghostly furniture as well as people, as if the magic were stronger here. I kept to the edges of the walkways, loath to feel the untouch of folk walking through me. There were many cushioned benches for waiting, another sure sign of officialdom, and many lesser scribes sitting at tables recording information from the scrolls presented to them. I went up yet another flight of stairs, but was frustrated by my quest for a clear view of the city by an immense window of stained glass. The image presented was one of a woman and a dragon. They did not appear to be at odds, but instead stood as if speaking to one another. The woman in this window had black hair and black eyes, and wore a band of bright red on her brow. She carried something in her left hand, but whether it was weapon or wand of office, I could not tell. The immense dragon wore a jeweled collar, but nothing else in its stance or demeanor suggested domestication. I stared at the window, light gleaming through its dusty colors, for several long minutes before I could go on. I felt it had some significance I could not quite grasp. At last, I turned away from it to survey this upper chamber. This floor was better lit than the other ones had been. It was all one huge open chamber, but substantially smaller than the main floor had been. Tall, narrow windows of clear glass alternated with stretches of wall ornately decorated with friezes of battles and agrarian scenes. I was drawn to the artwork,
but resolutely directed my steps to another staircase. This was not broad, but was a spiraling stair that I hoped led up to the tower I had glimpsed from outside the building. The city spirits seemed less numerous here. The climb was steeper and longer than I had expected it to be. I opened both my coat and my shirt before I reached the top. The winding steps were lit at intervals by windows scarce wider than arrow slits. At one, a young woman stood staring out over the city, an air of hopelessness in her lavender eyes. She seemed so real, I found myself begging her pardon as I stepped around her. She paid no heed, of course. Again, I had the eerie feeling that I was the ghost here. There were a few landings on this stair and doors leading to chambers, but these were locked, and time seemed to have been more merciful here. The dry air of the upper levels had preserved the wood and metal. I wondered what lay behind their undisturbed fastness. Gleaming treasure? The knowledge of the ages? Mouldering bones? None gave to my shovings, and as I continued up, I hoped I would not find a locked door as my reward at the top of the tower. The whole city was a mystery to me. The ghost life that teemed through it was such a contrast to its utter desertion now. I had seen no sign of battle. The only upheavals I had seen in the city seemed to be the result of the earth's deep unease. Here I passed more locked doors. I wonder if Ida herself knew what was behind them. No one locks a door unless he expects to return. I wondered where they had gone, the folk of this town, who still moved here as ghosts. Why was this river city abandoned? And when? Had this been the home of the elderlings? Were they the dragons I had seen on the buildings and in the stained-glass window? Some folk enjoy a puzzle. It gave me a pounding headache to complement the nagging hunger that had been growing in me since daybreak. I reached at last the upper tower chamber. It opened all around me. A round chamber with a domed ceiling, 16 panels made up the walls of the room, and 8 were of thick glass, streaked and filthy. They subdued the winter sunlight, flooding into the room through them, making it at once lit and gloomy. One of the windows was shattered and lay in shards both within and without the chamber, for a narrow parapet ran around the outside of the tower. A great round table was partially collapsed in the center of the room. 2 men and 3 women, all armed with pointers, were gesturing at where the table had once dominated the chamber, discussing something. One of the men seemed quite angry. I stepped around the phantom table and bureaucrats. A narrow door opened easily out onto the balcony. There was a wooden railing running about the edge of the parapet, but I did not trust it. Instead, I walked a slow circuit of that tower, caught between wonder and fear of falling. On the south side, a wide river valley spread out before me. In the far distance was an edging of dark blue hills that held up the pale winter sky. The river wound, a fat, lazy snake, through the near part of the valley. In the distance, I could see other towns on the river. Beyond the river was a wide green valley, thickly treed or populated with tidy farmsteads, which blinked in and out of existence when I shook my head to clear my eyes of ghosts. I saw a wide black bridge across the river, and the road continuing beyond it. I wondered where it led. Briefly, I saw bright towers glinting in the distance. I pushed the ghosts away from my mind and saw a distant lake with steam rising off it in the watery sunlight. Was Verity out there somewhere? My eyes wandered to the southeast and widened at what I saw there. Perhaps there was the answer to some of my questions. A whole section of the city was gone. Simply gone. No crumble of ruins were there.
No fire, blackened rubble. Only a great and sudden rift gaped in the earth, as if some vast giant had driven in a giant wedge and split it wide. The river had filled it in, a shining tongue of water intruding into the city. The remnants of buildings teetered on its edge still. Streets ended abruptly at the water. My eyes traced this huge wound in the earth. Even at this distance I could tell that the great crack extended beyond the far shore of the river. The destruction had plunged like a spear deep into the heart of the city. The placid water shone silver under the winter sky. I wondered if some sudden earthquake had been the death blow to this city. I shook my head. Too much of it remained standing still. No doubt it had been a great disaster, but it did not explain the city's death to me. I walked slowly around to the north side of the tower. The city spread out at my feet, and beyond it I saw vineyards and grain fields, and beyond them a forested stretch with the road running through it. Several days' ride away were the mountains. I shook my head to myself. By all my bearings I must have come from there, yet I did not recall the intervening journey at all. I leaned back against the wall and wondered what to do. If Verity were somewhere in this city, I felt no tingle of his presence. I wished I could recall why I had left my companions and when. "Come to me, come to me," whispered through my bones. An overwhelming dreariness rose up in me, and I longed simply to lie down where I was and die. I tried to tell myself it was the elf bark. It felt more like the after-effects of near-constant failure. I went back into the central chamber to get out of the chill winter wind. As I stepped back in through the shattered window, a stick rolled under my foot and I nearly fell. When I recovered, I glanced down and wondered that I had not noticed before. At the base of the broken window were the remains of a small fire. Soot had smudged some of the hanging glass remaining in the side part of the window frame. I stooped to touch it cautiously. My fingers came away black. It was not very fresh, but neither was it older than a few months. Otherwise the winter storms would have weathered more of it away. I stepped away and tried to make my weary mind work. The fire was made from wood, but it had included sticks, as from trees or bushes. Someone had deliberately carried small twigs up here to kindle this fire. Why? Why not use the remains of the table, and why climb this high to make a fire for the view? I sat down beside the remains of the fire and tried to think. When I leaned my back against the stone wall, it gave more substance to the arguing phantoms around the table. One shouted something at another, and then drew an imaginary line with his pointer over the collapsed table. One of the women crossed her arms across her chest and looked stubborn, while another smiled coldly and tapped with her own stick on the table. Cursing myself for an idiot, I leaped to my feet to look down at the ancient ruins of the table. The second that I perceived it was a map, I was sure Verity had made the fire. A foolish grin spread wide across my face. Of course! A tall windowed tower looking out over the city and surrounding countryside, and in the center of the room a great table holding the most peculiar map I had ever seen. It was not drawn on paper, but made of clay to mimic the rolling countryside. It had cracked in the collapsing of the table, but I could see how the river had been wrought of shining chips of black glass. There were tiny models of the buildings of the city beside the arrow-straight roads, tiny fountains filled with blue chips of glass, even twigs leafed with green wool to represent the greater trees in the city. At intervals throughout the city, small crystals of stone were fixed in the map. I suspected they represented compass points. All was there, even tiny squares to represent stalls in the market. Despite its ruin, it delighted the eye with its detail. I smiled. very certain that within months of Verity returning to Buckkeep, there would be a similar table and map in his skill tower. I bent over it, ignoring the phantoms to retrace my step. I located the map tower easily. As luck would have it, that section of the map was much cracked, but I was still fairly certain of my path as my fingers walked where my feet had the night before. Once more I marveled at the straightness of the roads and the precise intersections where they met. I was not certain exactly where I had first awakened the night before, but I was able to select a section of the city that was not too large and say, with certainty, it was within that square. My eye returned to the tower, and I carefully noted the number of intersections and the turns I must make to return to my starting point. Perhaps, once there, if I cast about, I might find something that would awaken my memories of the missing days. I wished suddenly for a bit of paper and a quill to sketch out the surrounding area. When I did so, the meaning of the fire was instantly clear. Verity had used a burnt stick to make his map. But upon what? I glanced around the room, but there were no hangings on these walls. Instead, the walls between the windows were slabs of white stone, incised with... I stood up to get a closer look. Wonder overtook me. I put my hand on the cold white stone and then peered out of the dirty window beside it. My fingers traced the river I could see in the distance, then found the smooth track of the road that crossed it. The view out of each window was represented by the panel beside it. Tiny glyphs and symbols might have been the names of towns or holdings. I scrubbed at the window, but most of the dirt was on the outside. The significance of the broken window was suddenly clear. Verity had broken out that pane for a clearer view of what lay beyond it. And then he had kindled that fire and used a burnt stick to copy something, probably to the map he had been carrying since Buckkeep. But what? I went to the broken window and studied the panels to either side of it. A hand had smeared the left one, wiping dust away from it. I set my own hand upon the print of Verity's palm in the dust. He had cleared this panel and stared out the window, and then copied something down. I could not doubt that it was his destination. I wondered if what was marked on the panel somehow coordinated with the markings on the map he had carried. I wished in vain that I had Ketrickin's copy with me to compare the two. Out of the window I could see the mountains to the north of me. I had come from there. I studied the view, and then tried to relate it to the etched panel beside me. The flickering ghosts of the past were no help. One moment I looked out over a forested countryside, the next I was looking at vineyards and grain fields. The only feature that was in common to both views was the black ribbon of road that went straight as an arrow to the mountains. My fingers tracked the road up the panel. There, in the distance, it reached the mountains. Some glyphs were marked there where the road diverged, and a tiny sparkle of crystal had been embedded in the panel there. I pushed my face close to the panel and tried to study the tiny glyphs there. Did they match the markings on Verity's map? Were they symbols Ketrickin would recognize? I left the tower room and hastened down the stairs, passing through phantoms that seemed to grow stronger and stronger. I heard their words clearly now, and caught glimpses of the tapestries that had once graced the walls. There were so many dragons depicted on them. Elderlings? I asked one of the echoing stone walls, and heard my words shivering up and down the stairs. I sought something to write upon. The tattered tapestries were damp rags that crumbled at a touch. What wood there was old and rotten. I broke down the door to one inner chamber, hoping to find its contents well preserved. Inside, I found the interior walls lined with wooden racks of pigeonholes, each holding a scroll. They looked substantial, as did the writing implements on the table in the center of the room. But my groping fingers found little more than ghosts of paper, crisp and fragile as ashes. My eyes showed me a stack of fresh vellums on a corner shelf. My groping fingers pushed away rotten debris to find, finally, a usable fragment no bigger than my two hands. It was stiff and yellowed, but it might serve. A heavy stoppered glass pot held the dried remnants of an ink. The wooden handles of their writing implements were gone, but the metal tips had survived, and they were long enough for me to grasp firmly. Armed with these supplies, I returned to the map room. Spittle restored the ink to life, and I honed the metal nib on the floor until it shone clean again. I rekindled the remnants of Verity's fire, for the afternoon was becoming overcast, and the light through the dusty windows was dimming. I knelt in front of the panel Verity's hand had dusted, and copied as much as I could of the road, mountains, and other features onto the scrap of stiffened leather. Painstakingly, I squinted at the tiny glyphs, and transferred as many of them as I could to the vellum. Perhaps Ketrickin could make sense of them. Perhaps, when we compared this clumsy map of mine to the map she carried, some common feature would make sense. It was all I had to go on. The sun was setting outside, and my fire no more than embers when I finally finished. I looked down on my scratchings, ruefully. Neither Verity nor Fedrin would have been impressed with my work. But it would have to do. When I was certain the ink was set and would not smear, I put the vellum inside my shirt to carry it. I would not chance rain or snow on it to blur my markings. I left the tower as night was falling. My ghostly companions had long since gone home to hearth and supper. I walked the streets among scores of folk seeking their homes or venturing out for an evening's pleasure. I passed inns and taverns that seemed to blaze with light, and heard merry voices from within. It was becoming harder and harder for me to see the truth of the empty streets and abandoned buildings. It was a special misery to walk with my belly growling and my throat dry past inns where phantoms filled themselves with ghostly cheer and shouted aloud to one another in greeting. My plans were simple. I would go to the river and drink. Then I would do my best to return to the first place I remembered in the city. I would find some sort of shelter in that vicinity for the night, and by morning light I would head back toward the mountains. I hoped if I went by that path, I had probably used to come here. Something would stimulate my memory. I was kneeling by the river's edge, one palm flat on the paving stone, drinking cold water, when the dragon appeared. One moment the sky above me was empty. Then there was a golden light on everything, and the noise of great wings beating like the whirring of a pheasant's wings in flight. About me, folk cried out, some in startlement, and some in delight. The creature dived down on us and circled low. The wake of wind it put out set the ships to rocking and the river to rippling. Once more it circled, and then, without warning, it plunged completely out of sight in the river. The golden light it had shed was extinguished, and the night seemed all the darker by comparison. I jerked back reflexively from the dream wave that leaped against the shore as the river absorbed the dragon's impact. All around me, people were staring expectantly at the water. I followed their gazes. At first, I saw nothing. Then the water parted, and a great head emerged from the river. Water dripped from it, and ran gleaming down the golden serpentine neck that next appeared. All the tales I had ever been told had alluded to dragons as worms or lizards or snakes. But as this one emerged from the river, holding out its dripping wings, I found myself thinking of birds. graceful cormorants rising out of the sea from a dive after fish, or brightly plumaged pheasants, came to my mind as the huge creature emerged. It was fully as large as one of the ships, and the spread of its wings put the canvas sails to shame. It paused on the riverbanks and preened the water from its scaled wings. The word scale does no justice to the ornate plates that sheathed its wings, yet feather is too airy a word to describe them. Could a feather be made of finely beaten gold? Perhaps it might come close to the dragon's plumage. I was transfixed with delight and wonder. The creature ignored me, emerging from the river so close to me that had it been real, I would have been soaked by the water that dripped from its outstretched wings. Every drop that fell back into the river carried the unmistakable shimmer of raw magic with it. The dragon paused on the riverbank, its four great clawed feet sinking deep in the damp earth as it carefully folded its wings and then preened its long, forked tail. Golden light bathed me and illuminated the gathering crowd. I turned away from the dragon to regard them. Welcome shone in their faces and great deference. The dragon had the bright eyes of a gerfalcon and the carriage of a stallion as it strode up to them. The folk parted to make way for it, murmuring respectful greetings. Elderling, I said aloud to myself. I followed it, my fingers trailing the building fronts, one with the entranced crowd, as it paraded slowly up the street. Folk poured from taverns to add their greetings and swelled the crowd that followed it. Obviously this was no common event. I do not know what I hoped to discover by following it. I do not think I really thought of anything at that time, save to follow this immense, charismatic creature. I understood now the reason why the main streets of this city had been built so wide. It was not to allow the passage of wagons, but so that nothing might impede one of these great visitors. It paused once before a great stone basin. Folk rushed forward to vie for the honor of working a windlass of sorts. Bucket after bucket rose on a loop of chain, each spilling its cargo of liquid magic into the basin. When the basin brimmed with the shimmering stuff, the elderling gracefully bowed its neck and drank. Ghost skill, it might be, but even the sight of it awakened that insidious hunger in me. Twice more the basin was filled, and twice more the elderling drank it down before it proceeded on its way. I followed, marveling at what I had seen. Ahead of us suddenly loomed that great gash of destruction that marred the city's symmetrical form. I followed the ghostly procession to the lip of it, only to see everyone, man, woman, and elderling, vanish completely as they strode unconcernedly out into the space. In a short time I stood alone on the edge of that gaping crevasse, hearing only the wind whispering over the still deep water. A few patches of stars showed through the overcast sky and were reflected in the black water. Whatever other secrets of the elderlings I might have learned had been swallowed long ago in that great cataclysm. I turned and walked away slowly, wondering where the elderling had been bound and for what purpose. I shuddered again as I recalled how it had drunk down the silver, gleaming power. It took me some time to retrace my steps first to the river. Once there, I focused my mind on recalling what I had seen in the map room earlier that day. My hunger was a hollow thing that rattled against my ribs now, but I resolutely ignored it as I threaded my way through the streets. The strength of will carried me through a knot of brawling shadows, but my resolution failed me when the city guard came charging down the streets on their massive horses. I hopped to one side to let them pass, and winced as I heard the sounds of their falling truncheons. Unreal as it was, I was glad to leave the noisy discord behind me. I made a right turn up a slightly narrower street, and walked on past three more intersections. I halted. Here. This was the plaza where I had been kneeling in the snow the night before. There, that pillar standing at its center, I recalled some sort of monument or sculpture looming over me. I walked toward it. It was made of the same ubiquitous black stone veined with gleaming crystal. To my weary eyes it seemed to gleam brighter with the same mysterious unlight the other structures gave off. The faint, shining, outlined on its side glyphs cut deep into its surface. I walked slowly around it. Some, I was sure, were familiar and perhaps twin to those I had copied earlier in the day. Was this, then, some sort of guidepost, labeled with destinations according to compass headings? I reached out a hand to trace one of the familiar glyphs. The night bent around me. A wave of vertigo swept over me. I clutched at the column for support, but somehow missed it, and went stumbling forward. My outstretched hands found nothing, and I fell face forward into crusted snow and ice. For a time, I just lay there, my cheek against the icy road, blinking my useless eyes at the blackness of the night. Then, a warm, solid weight hit me. My brother. Night Eyes greeted me joyously. He thrust his cold nose into my face and pawed at my head to rouse me. I knew you would come back. I knew it.
28. The Coterie. Part of the great mystery that surrounds the Elderlings is that the few images we have of them bear small resemblance to each other. This is true not only of tapestries and scrolls that are copies of older works and hence might contain errors, but also of the few images of Elderlings that have survived from King Wisdom's time. Some of the images bear superficial resemblance to the legends of dragons, featuring wings, claws, scaly skin, and great size. But others do not. In at least one tapestry, the Elderling is depicted as smaller to a human, but gold of skin and great of size. The images do not even agree in the number of limbs that benevolent race possessed. They may have as many as 4 legs and 2 wings also, or have no wings at all, and walk upon 2 legs as a man. It has been theorized that so little was written about them, because knowledge of the Elderlings at that time was regarded as common knowledge. Just as no one sees fit to create scrolls that deals with the most basic attributes of what a horse is, for it would serve no useful purpose, so no one thought that one day Elderlings would be the stuff of legends. To a certain degree this makes sense, but one has only to look about at all the scrolls and tapestries in which horses are featured as the stuff of common life, to find a flaw. Were Elderlings so accepted a part of life, surely they would have been more often depicted. After a very confusing hour or two, I found myself back in the yurt with the others. That night seemed all the colder for my having spent an almost warm day in the city. We huddled in the tent, in our blankets. They had told me I had vanished from the lip of the cliff only the night before. I had told them of all I had encountered in the city. There had been a certain amount of disbelief on everyone's part. I had felt both moved and guilty to see how much anguish my disappearance had caused them. Starling had obviously been weeping, while both Kettle and Ketrickin had the owly look of folks who had not slept. The fool had been the worst, pale and silent, with a slight trembling to his hands. It had taken a bit of time for all of us to recover. Kettle had cooked a meal twice the size of what we usually had, and all save the fool had eaten heartily.
He did not seem to have the energy. While the others sat in a circle around the brazier listening to my tale, he was already curled in his blankets, the wolf snug beside him. He seemed completely exhausted. After I had been over the details of my adventure for the third time, Kettle commented cryptically,
"Well, thank Ida you were dosed with elf bark before you were taken. Otherwise, you would never have kept your wits at all."
"You say, taken?" I pressed immediately. She scowled at me.
"You know what I mean."
She looked about at all of us, staring at her.
"Through the guidepost, or whatever it is. They must have something to do with it."
A silence met her words.
"It seems obvious to me, that's all."
"He left us at one, and arrived there at one, and returned to us the same way."
"But why didn't they take anyone else?" I protested.
"Because you are the only skill-sensitive one among us,"
she pointed out. "Are they skill-wrought as well?" I asked her bluntly. She met my glance.
"I looked at the guidepost by daylight. It is hewn of black stone and wide threads of shining crystal in it. Like the walls of the city you describe, did you touch both posts?"
I was silent a moment, thinking.
"I believe so."
She shrugged.
"Well, there you are. A skill-imbued object can retain the intent of its maker. Those posts were erected to make travel easier for those who could master them."
"I've never heard of such things. How do you know them?"
"I am only speculating on what seems obvious to me,"
she told me stubbornly.
"And that is all I'm going to say. I'm going to sleep. I'm exhausted. We all spent the entire night and most of the day looking for you and worrying about you. What hours we could rest, that wolf never stopped howling."
"Howling? I called you. You did not answer. I did not hear you, or I would have tried. I begin to fear, little brother. Forces pull at you, taking you to places I cannot follow, closing your mind to mine. This, right now, is as close as I have ever come to being accepted into a pack, but if I lost you, even it would be lost to me. You will not lose me," I promised him, but I wondered if it was a promise I could keep.
"Fitz,"
Ketrickin asked in a nudging voice.
"I am here," I assured her. "Let us look at the map you copied."
I took it out and she drew out her own map. We compared the two. It was hard to find any similarities, but the scales of the maps were different. At last we decided that the piece I had copied down in the city bore a superficial resemblance to the portion of trail that was drawn on Ketrickin's map. "This place," I gestured to one destination marked on her map, "would seem to be the city. If that is so, then this corresponds to this, and this to this." The map Verity had set out with had been a copy of this older, faded map. On that one, the trail I now thought of as the Skill Road had been marked, but oddly, as a path that began suddenly in the mountains and ended abruptly at three separate destinations. The significance of those endpoints had once been marked on the map, but those markings had faded into inky smears. Now, we only had the map I had copied in the city, with those three endpoints on it also. One had been the city itself, the other two were now our concern. Ketrickin studied the glyphs I had copied from the city's map.
"I've seen such markings from time to time,"
she admitted, uneasily.
"No one truly reads them anymore. A handful of them are still known. One encounters them mostly in odd places. In a few places in the mountains, there are raised stones that have such marks. There are some at the west end of the Great Chasm Bridge. No one knows when they were carved or why. Some are thought to mark graves, but others say they marked land boundaries."
"Can you read any of them?" I asked her.
"A few. They are used in a challenge game. Some are stronger than others."
Her voice trailed off as she studied my scratchings.
"None match exactly the ones I know.
she said at last, disappointment heavy in her voice. This one is almost like the one for stone, but the others I have not seen at all. Well, it's one of the ones that was marked here. I tried to make my voice sound cheery. Stone conveyed nothing at all to me. It seems closest to where we are. Shall we go there next?
I would have liked to see the city, the fool said softly. I should have liked to see the dragon, too.
I nodded slowly. It is a place and a thing worth seeing. Much knowledge is there, if only we had the time to ferret it out. Did not I have Verity always in my head with his come to me, come to me? I think I would have been more curious to explore. I said nothing to them of my dreams of Molly and Chade. Those were private things, as was my ache to be home with her again.
Doubtless you would have,
Kettle agreed.
And doubtless gotten yourself into more trouble that way. I wonder, did he so bind you to keep you on the road and protect you from distractions?
I would have challenged her again on her knowledge, had not the fool repeated softly,
I would have liked to see the city.
We should all sleep now. We are up at first light to travel hard tomorrow. It heartens me to think that Verity had been there before Fitzchivalry, even as it fills me with foreboding. We must get to him quickly. I can no longer stand wondering each night why he never returned.
Comes a catalyst to make stone of flesh and flesh of stone. At his touch shall be wakened the dragons of the earth. The sleeping city shall tremble and waken to him. Comes a catalyst.
The fool's voice was dreamy.
The writings of White Damir,
Kettle added reverently. She looked at me for a moment, was annoyed.
Hundreds of years of writings and prophecies, and they all terminate in you?
Not my fault, I said inanely. I was already rucking my way into my blankets. I thought longingly of the almost warm day I had had. The wind was blowing, and I felt chill to the bone. I was drowsing off when the fool reached over to pat my face with a warm hand.
Good you're alive,
he muttered. Thank you, I said. I was summoning up Kettle's game board and pieces in an effort to keep my mind to myself for the night. I had just begun to contemplate the problem. Suddenly, I sat up, exclaiming, Your hand is warm, fool! Your hand is warm!
Go to sleep,
Starling chided me in an offended tone. I ignored her. I dragged the blanket down from the fool's face and touched his cheek. His eyes opened slowly. You're warm, I told him. Are you all right?
I don't feel warm,
he informed me miserably.
I feel cold and very, very tired.
I began building up the fire in the brazier hastily. Around me the others were stirring. Starling across the tent had sat up and was peering at me through the gloom. The fool is never warm, I told them, trying to make them understand my urgency. Always, when you touch his skin, it is cool. Now he's warm.
Indeed?
Starling asked in an oddly sarcastic voice.
Is he ill?
Kettle asked tiredly. I don't know. I've never known him to be ill in my whole life.
I am seldom ill,
the fool corrected me quietly.
But this is a fever I have known before. Lie down and sleep, Fitz. It'll be all right. I expect the fever will have burned out by morning.
Whether it has or not, we must travel tomorrow morning, Kettricken said implacably. We have already lost a day lingering here.
Lost a day? I exclaimed, almost angrily. Gained a map, or more detail of one, and knowledge that Verity had been to the city. For myself, I doubt not that he went there as I did, and perhaps returned to this very spot. We have not lost a day, Ketriken, but gained all the days it would have taken us to find a way down to what remains to the road down there, and then tramp to the city and back again. As I recall, you had proposed spending a day just to seek a way down that slide. Well, we did, and we found the way. I paused. I took a breath and imposed calm on my voice. I will not seek to force any of you to my will. But the fool is not well enough to travel tomorrow. I shall not travel either. A glint came into Ketriken's eyes, and I braced myself for battle. But the fool forestalled it.
I shall travel tomorrow, well or not.
He assured us both.
That's settled, then,
Ketriken said swiftly. Then, in a more humane voice, she asked,
Fool, is there anything I can do for you? I would not use you so harshly, were not the need so great. I have not forgotten, and never shall, that without you, I would never have reached Jampe alive.
I sensed a story I was not privy to, but kept my questions to myself.
I will be fine. I am just... Fitz, could I beg some elf bark of you? That warmed me last night as nothing else has.
Certainly. I was rummaging in my pack for it when Kettle spoke out warningly.
Fool, I counsel you against it. It is a dangerous herb and almost often more damaging than good. Who knows but you are ill tonight because you had some night before last?
It is not that potent an herb, I said disdainfully. I've used it for a number of years and taken no lasting ill from it. Kettle gave a snort.
None that you are wise enough to see, anyway, she said sarcastically.
But it is a warming herb that gives energy to the flesh, even if it is deadening to the spirit.
I always found it restored me rather than deadened me, I countered, as I found the small packet and opened it. Without my asking her, Kettle got up to put water on to boil. I never noticed it dulling my mind. I added,
The one taking it seldom does, she retorted. And while it may boost your physical energy for a time, you must always pay for it later. Your body is not to be tricked, young man. You will know that better when you are as old as I.
I fell silent. As I thought back over the times I had used Elfbark to restore myself, I had the uncomfortable suspicion that she was at least partly right. But my suspicion was not enough to keep me from brewing two cups, rather than just one. Kettle shook her head at me, but lay back down and said no more. I sat beside the fool as we drank our tea. Then he handed me back the empty mug. His hand seemed warmer, not cooler.
Your fever is rising, I warned him.
No, it is just the heat of the mug on my skin, he suggested.
I ignored him. You are shaking all over.
A bit, he admitted.
Then his misery broke through and he said,
I am cold as I have ever been before. My back and my jaws ache from shaking with it.
Flank him, suggested Night Eyes.
The big wolf shifted to press more closely against him. I added my blankets to those covering the fool, and then crawled in beside him. He said not a word, but his shivering lessened somewhat.
I can't recall that you were ever ill at Buckkeep, I said quietly.
I was, but very seldom, and kept to myself. As you recall, the healer,